laws throughout the Middle East is to make women have a legal right, I mean a legal responsibility to be obedient to their husbands. And so that translates into, for example, laws in Sudan and Saudi Arabia that women in Iran, that women can't travel without permission from their husbands or the fathers or whoever their legal guardians, that their legal guardians have can decide whether they're allowed to work, whether they're allowed to be educated abroad. Okay. Another question, which Irina was going to talk about, but is polygamy. The fact that in since this Islamic movement has begun, there had been some move to make polygamy more conditional in Pakistan and Iran and Sudan and Egypt. Since this has started, men's right to unilateral right to marry as up to four wives has been restored, while women don't have the same right. Same goes for divorce laws. Damina says that there should be a period of waiting between between the number of times that a man renounces his wife. That's not always the way it's been interpreted. For example, in Pakistan, a man can say it, you know, in one, say it at once, and a woman would be divorced, whereas a woman has to go to court or to an arbitration to be divorced, so that seems unfair. Then the question of inheritance. It's true that in the Islamic system, a man would have a legal responsibility to support the women in his family. But on the other hand, a lot of people here would argue that a more fair system, that a lot of women would prefer to have the independence of inheriting their own money rather than to be dependent on a brother or husband or father. And then the fifth question, the question of hijab or veiling, something that's very controversial in the Middle East, and I'd have to agree completely with Amina that women should have the right to dress in whatever way they please. And for example, in Turkey, one of the big debates is that women are not allowed to wear hijab in government institutions, and many people consider that a violation of their human rights, just as they consider it a violation of women's human rights in Iran, in Sudan, in Saudi Arabia, and other places where they are legally required to wear a veil, or in Afghanistan. So, those are some of the main issues that were raised in the articles, and those are some of the things that these political movements have focused on as far as women are concerned. And that's the time.
All right, we've finished with the first part of tonight's format. Before we start the second part, I noticed there are people standing at the back of the room. Again, if you came late, I would like to inform you that there is a hall immediately to my left with a projection screen, and you may go in there and sit down and you won't miss a thing, okay? I would also like to remind you that there will be a question and answer session coming up, and if you would like to submit a written question, please write it down and pass it to the person on the aisle, and someone from the MSA will be collecting those questions before that part of the debate starts. The second part of the debate consists of a discussion between the two speakers regarding certain issues which were discussed in the statements and were addressed in the Women of the Veil articles. I guess the logical place to start is with some of the five areas indicated in Ms. Scroggins' opening statements dealing with Sharia, Islamic law, and women. Specifically, I guess I would like to invite both speakers, and maybe I will ask Amina Sumi to go first, regarding what the Islamic viewpoint is on women's testimony, men's testimony, and the fornication law situation in Pakistan.
It's true that the Zina law of Pakistan is as she described it. It's also true that it's not Islamic. Okay, in the Quran, it gives very clear guidance, and just a second. I'm going to get my glasses so I can read. to the reporter earlier, now I can't find it, right, like this. Okay, basically, it states that in the Quran, that if there are not four witnesses, that the man can testify four times, and on the fifth time, that he can ask the wrath of God, okay? But then after that, the woman is given the same opportunity, and if she bears witness four times, and then on the fifth, ask the wrath of God, that she's declared innocent. And that's what it says in the Quran itself. And so that's what has to apply. In this instance, the woman's testimony is stronger than what her husband's testimony is. The fact that there are all of these women in the prisons in Pakistan cannot be denied. And the International Union of Muslim Women is working on this, but we face a very big problem in that we're having to educate the masses a little bit about Islam. And we can't just change the law, we're also going to have to make provisions for the women that are in the prisons. Because we can't send them back to their families because their families have not been educated and do not have the knowledge and the understanding, and they would do injury to them, and we know this. So while I'm standing here and telling you about Islam, it's Islam the ideal. It's not what's being practiced in Pakistan or any other place. These are cultural horrors, if you will, and the situation for the women when it comes to this is definitely a horror.
Would you like to make any comment?
Well, maybe I could ask a question.
Okay.
It's true that Pakistan does have a peculiar specific set of laws, but on the larger issue of the fornication laws as they should be, and the question of segregation of men and women, which do you support? Do you think that should be a legal obligation of the state?
Okay, fornication and adultery are not personal, all right? They are crimes against society because they affect the entire family and the entire community. Adultery can be the cause of divorce. Fornication can be the cause of children who have no legal rights, who have no parents. These are crimes against society. Mm. These are not, the way they're accepted here, it's like, yo, it's nothing, okay, you go to bed, whatever, okay. It's just not, this isn't reality. Bad things come out of fornication, bad things come out of adultery, and they affect other people, not just the one person. So you have to be held accountable. You don't sacrifice all of society's rights for individual rights. There has to be a balance between individual and society. If you gotta have sex, you gotta get married. As simple as that.
Well, what would you think about... Oh.
Wait a minute. In Islam, all praise is for Allah, and I really ask you not to applaud anything that I say. If there's anything, please, you know, the praise is for Allah.
Well, what sort of measures, what do you think about some of the measures that have been taken in certain Islamic countries to keep men and women separate to prevent any sort of fornication or adultery from happening? You know, we can go through examples if you'd like.
Well, I don't think that absolute separation has any necessary place because the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he ate with women that he wasn't married to. He ate from the same pot with them. He met and talked with them. He taught them. The total segregation actually comes from cultures outside of Islam, and it isn't necessary. Okay, that carries it too far. I agree to that. But the absolute total free mixing, this also is not necessary. If we're dealing with men on a level of business, on a level of education, on a level of profession, as a doctor or as a nurse or as a teacher or as a lawyer or whatever, that's one thing. But in the social mixing, with things like dancing and with a lot of other things that go on with social mixing. Now again, you're running into areas that can definitely cause problems. Very few women, if they were really being truthful, could say that if they saw their husband across a crowded room in a deep conversation with a voluptuous, beautiful woman in a skimpy gown, that she wouldn't have pangs of jealousy and suspicion. Very few really truthful men could say that if they saw their wives across a crowded room talking with a hunk that could compete with Adonis, that they wouldn't have some serious pangs of jealousy that could lead to suspicion. Jealousy is like a disease, and it grows, and it leads to serious problems in serious relationships. So absolute free mingling, there's not any need for it.
So you would support, you think that it is the role of the state to step in and prevent those sort of encounters?
Yes, I do.
Let me ask a follow-up question. One of the things, Sister, that you discussed in your opening statement was that men and women are different, but this does not affect their equality. To a Westerner, if he hears that, he thinks, well, if they're saying that they're different, then they have to, by definition, be not the same and are therefore in some manner unequal. How do you respond to the line of questioning that unless you treat them the same, they are in fact not equal?
Well, same and equal aren't the same. Even if you read in Webster, the definition in Webster for same and equal would not be the same. Same means without difference. And vive la différence. Men and women are different. Apples and oranges are different. Cats and dogs are different. It doesn't mean that one is less important than the other, that one has less value than the other. It just means that they're different. And the Quran states that we still have the same obligations. We have the same punishment for a crime. We have the same chance of getting into heaven. We have the same reward for the same deed done. There's no difference in the eyes of Allah. But to eat an orange, you peel it. To eat an apple, you don't.
Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think that there's, you know, as we've gone over, I mean, there's certain areas of the law where women are clearly are treated differently, and I would argue that, I mean, we had a debate in this country over separate but equal. Is that possible? And, you know, obviously I would side on the error to the side that they're treated differently under the law, and therefore it's not the same and it's not equal. Men have certain rights that women don't.
Okay. My next question, or the next area that I'd like to address, is in your article, by the way, most of you may not know that the article Women of the Veil, which appeared in the Milwaukee Journal, is actually a condensation of approximately 12 pages of newspaper articles down to 2 pages in the Milwaukee Journal. I would like to ask what kind of research and what kind of persons you talk to gain the understanding of Islam and Islamic law, which are contained in your article.
Well, as I said, I've been covering the Middle East and writing about it for some time, but on this particular trip, we specifically tried to talk to political leaders, ordinary people who were affected by the laws, women who were active on both sides of the issues, lawyers. And why did we do that rather than, say, talking to Islamic scholars is a question that I've been asked a lot. And although I did try to read that and talk to some of them, but the reason was because we're not interested in trying to establish, you know, the question that people have asked for 1,400 years, you know, what is Islam, how should it be? That wasn't our question at all. It was, how is it being interpreted in certain countries right now, today? You know, how about this political movement that is actually in the Middle East today? What are they trying to do, and why are they trying to do it, and how are people responding to it? So that, for example, there's a lot of things that I talk about in the articles, like, for example, different types of veiling, where, you know, people from another country will argue that Afghanistan is far too strict, it's not required by Islam, it's, you know, and their kind of total strict separation of the sexes is going too far, but to many Afghans, that is Islam. That's how they interpret it. So that's what we were interested in looking at, you know, how were people on the spot interpreting Islam.
Okay, would you recognize that there is a distinction to be made between Islam as it is contained in the Quran and the tradition of the Prophet and how different cultures may be interpreting it today?
Well, sure. I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, a billion Muslims in the world. Everyone is going to have a different interpretation of it, of Islam and what it is and what the Quran actually says. But there are some common areas, and like I said, well, I was not looking at the Quran and, you know, are these people interpreting it right or wrong, but instead just saying, here's how they are interpreting it now, and here's where they derive it from, where they get their legitimacy from in the Quran. Whether they've done that correctly or not is a different matter.
Could I ask Sister Sumi to comment on how different cultures have interacted with Islam?
Well, I'll be one of the first to admit that I see a lot of cultural pollution in Islam. And it's very distressing, not only to me, but to everyone else, because the cultural pollution is one of the things that keeps the Muslims from coming together. The thing about it is that in spite of the cultural pollution, no matter where someone is from, I can take this book and I can sit them down and I can say, okay, you do that in your country, but explain to me, why does it say this here? And 9 times out of 10, they come back and they will change what they were saying, because here we have the Word of God, the Word of Allah. And all of the Muslims, no matter where they're from, are willing to accept this. And this was what we took before the Parliament 1.5 years ago in Pakistan and presented these ayahs regarding zina. They had to accept, they couldn't argue with. And it's these ayahs, this book, that will get those laws changed. Whether or not cultures are practicing things wrong or not is, to me in this case, almost irrelevant. If we were writing about the cultural practices of Catholics in Central America, or in Peru, or in Africa, or in Italy, or wherever, it would be listed as the practices of a particular country, and being Catholic would never come into it in spite of what they do being done by their interpretation of Catholicism. But whatever any Muslim does is by our media laid on all of us. And that's my objection. And if someone's going to write about Islam, you can look and talk to whoever you want to, and you can find somebody to say anything. We did an experiment in one community where we invited 13 different scholars into our community, and each time we had someone meet with them and lead them towards feeling that the community was a certain way, and we got all kinds of different verdicts on the issue that we put forward to them. You can find people to give whatever answer. But this is something different. And so, like, the issue of whether a woman could testify or not in Pakistan should have been said that, but then just reading these two verses of the Quran would have made it very clear that it's not Islamic to do that. And it distresses me that people of other religions in other countries, it's never put on their religion. It's not blamed on their religion. But with us, everything is blamed on our religion. And that people want to look at us through their eyes, they don't want to look at us through our eyes and see how we see ourselves and see what we are feeling and what we are thinking. I am American. I am a Muslim. And I want people to know what Islam is. And I want people to accept me as a human being, as a Muslim, in my hijab. But
if journalists continue writing things that make people think that Muslims are ignorant fools for being Muslim, then I can't blame you guys for looking at me and giggling and snickering as I'm walking down the hallway in my abaya. I can't blame you. If I weren't a Muslim, if I didn't understand the way I look, then I might laugh at myself too. We're walking in here. When I first walked in, I walked past a group of students, and one of them almost fell on the floor laughing. He'd probably never seen anyone dressed like me. But that hurts. That's offensive. It doesn't make me insecure, but it's offensive and it hurts because my rights are being impended on. And one of the things that helps this is the way people present Islam all the time.
I will just raise one more issue before proceeding to the question and answer period with the audience. That issue has to do with the quotes from the Quran which are contained in the Women of the Veil series. My question to Deborah Scroggins is for the quotations from the Quran which were contained in the series. What translation did you choose and why did you choose it?
It's the Dawood, it's the Penguin translation, perfectly, simply, it's paperback. It was for sale in Pakistan, I bought it, you know. I had a smaller book called The Social Laws of the Quran, and then I found out that I really wasn't going to be able to get by with that. I needed to read the entire Quran, so that was the one that I bought. It just happened to be, no particular reason.
Okay.
It just happened to be the one.
Sister, you read some of these passages quoting or translating the Quran contained in the Women of the Veil articles. Do you believe that those quotations contained in those articles are accurate?
They're probably accurate according to him. It's kind of beneficial if you know, when you're looking at a book on a particular subject, that you find someone who is knowledgeable of the particular subject, preferably when it comes to religion that they're practicing. I know that all over the world, and I chose to bring this one, I have 17 different translations, but this is the Yusuf Ali, and I know that this is the one that is read a great deal in Pakistan, but not as much as the Maududi, which I also have. And those would have been much better, and I think if she had read one of those instead of the one by this guy who's an Arab, but he's not a Muslim. It states so in the book, at the beginning of the book, it states that he is an Arab, but not a Muslim. And he does have, when I first reviewed the book, I advised against it because of the fact that he has ayats mixed up and he has things that are just way off the wall. Because I can take any of my 17 translations and read the same ayats and come back with pretty close to the same thing, just a change in a word here or there. Except for when you get into it like this. So I don't blame Deborah for that one, except that I wish she had read in the front of the book that he was who he was, and then she might not have chosen that one.
Okay, that concludes tonight's program.
So I said, okay, I am open-minded now. I don't think like a Jehovah's Witness. I'm going to find out if these people are liars, if they are no good or whatever. I'm going to find out for myself.
It was Mr. Muhammad's son, Wallace Muhammad, who encouraged me to make the pilgrimage to Mecca and get myself orientated into the knowledge of the Orthodox religion of Islam.
I became, alhamdulillah, a Muslim by the grace of Allah. But I had been doing some work. I'd been seeking.
Got a church and we try everything else, but there's still that void. And over the 17 years, I've been reaffirmed in this choice over and over again that this is indeed the better choice, the better alternative, and it will lead to the successes that we were pursuing in life.
It's the story of an American man, who, me in this case, who's confronted with Islam and is asked to make a choice. And at that moment, I chose Islam.